Essay 14. Today, the woods looked like a super sprawling bronze monument park. Everything. The mazes of trees, each leaf, trunk, branch, burnished with the patina of great age. I have a migraine, and it rained last night, both of which have a stultifying effect on my synapses. No connections, no explosions, almost no language, actually. I've gotten migraines at a rate of one or two a week since I was about 12. My father had them, exactly the same rhythm, so I suppose it's hereditary. Fortunately, mine are tractable in that I can work through them, seem pretty normal, do what I need to do. Maybe twice a year I am incapacitated, though I have never missed a day of work solely for a migrainous event. As was the case for my father, who generally got his worst headaches on Saturday night, the work week over, mine tend to come not during the stress time, but the downtime immediately following it. I've tried a variety of treatments and techniques to stop or minimize them, none of which worked in any meaningful way. I gave up on all that about 25 years ago when a migraine specialist prescribed a drug I would have to self-inject into my thigh. I hate needles, pass out when I give blood, so that was a big barrier. Still, I entertained it, until he said he wanted me to do the first couple of injections in the office. I asked why. He said it was possible for the drug to induce a heart attack, and immediate treatment would be necessary. I decided right then to forego the medication entirely. A headache is bad, but at least it's not a heart attack. Not long after that, maybe as a way to persuade myself that I wasn't that unlucky after all to have inherited this malady, I started to think of these migraines as my friends in that they compelled my head to come to a stop, or at least go on standby, like regular fortuitous electrical outages that induced rest. My brain does some pretty wild things when the wires are whirring. If I did that 24/7 for months, it would be fried. Migraines make it pause, make me pause, like today. So I was walking among the bronze monuments, not thinking about anything. I turned one of my corners to the right, as I almost always do, now down the hill. Carol and I used to turn left, up a short, steep hill to a wider path where we could walk side by side together. That path makes me sad now, so I don't take it. About 50 feet down my path, I became aware of a loud swell of bird sounds from what must have been, I guess, a very large crowd of them, up the other way, out of sight. It was like 1,000 squeaking wheels. The noise made up many tiny intermittent chirps that on the whole sounded like one continuous stream or scream. I was intrigued, but kept on a few more steps away from them. I rarely turn around for any reason. Driving, walking, working, thinking, whatever. It's just my temperament. Back doesn't exist. Just ahead. Go. Today, though, I did. I went back, went up the incline, the noise getting louder and louder. Clearly, a huge flock of birds had decided to stop in a stand of trees, a group that for some reason was still leafed out in green. The birds had congregated about 100 yards up the hillside from me, a great din pouring down. I strained and squinted to identify what they were, but try as I might, not one bird was visible. They all just blended into the backdrop. Someone who didn't know what birds were might think it was the trees getting chippy over the stresses of the season, commiserating up there. Then one took flight, a few seconds up, flitting, then alighting, again, instantly evaporating into the backdrop. It all happened so fast and so far off, I couldn't tell what kind of bird it might be. Maybe a bit smaller than a robin and flitty in flight, fast, changing direction, almost like a bat. Then a group of three did the same thing. Then one larger explosion of maybe a dozen, up, swirls, gone. I still couldn't tell what they were and didn't want to scramble up through the brambles to get closer. Partly for me, too lazy, partly for them. Why flush them up just because I need a name to go with what was already a memorable eavesdrop on their voices? So I kept on, and the din gradually diminished at my back until it was gone. I have what might seem like a very peculiar relationship with natural events of this sort. My instinctive tendency is to think they are there to teach me something. I actually wrote a poem about that maybe 25 years ago, at exactly this time of year, in fact. It is called Indian Summer. The sassafras I sin under is a tangle of mango-colored hands. With each easy breeze, they wave bravely, cavalierly even, as if there were no such thing as November. Lots of other leaves flutter down around me, beech, maple, oak, one, a couple, a dozen at a time. They are crisp and flat and make a pleasant clatter. But the sassafras leaves stay where they are. They are August sundown oranges growing more and more gorgeous in the warm, late morning light. I try to figure out what they are here to teach me. I already know every shade of sundown they can think of. I know the secret of holding on when others can't. And I know all about November. Still, I cannot turn away. I decide to sit a little longer than I planned. Enjoy while I can. This heat, the breeze, these mango-colored hands. I won't spend a lot of time reading into it. I want just to locate that instinctive tendency I have in the face of certain perceptions. I teach Wordsworth and Coleridge's lyrical ballads quite often in my Gen Ed Lit course. Two of the poems I spend time on are the tandem of expostulation and reply and The Tables Turned, in which two young men, William and Matthew, argue back and forth about where knowledge resides and how we should best acquire it. In the first poem, Matthew is giving William a hard time about lazing around, just sitting blankly on an old gray stone instead of reading, studying. Matthew says knowledge is in books and it takes hard work to get it. William says it's in nature and is received directly via a wise passiveness, against or with our will. One of the standout lines in that argument is William's command to let nature be your teacher. I read poetry always in the most matter-of-fact manner I can, which is to say that in a case such as this, I want to actualize in my head some set of attitudes or behaviors that might help me to implement at the level of daily practice what that all would work like, how it would play out, what it would lead to, letting nature be my teacher, for example. In this case, I happen to have a plethora of experiences that allow me to say, yes, I know exactly what that means. With other poems, I have to work hard over a long period of time to get that built into the blood, brain, and bone sense of what they might mean, how they might make an actual embodied difference in my life, how I would do that. It is a process I genuinely enjoy, this translation of words into my body, into my life. What else is literature for, I guess I'd say, if not for that, to enliven and enlarge our experiential connections with the world? In any case, today, I couldn't think of one thing those birds were there to teach me. They just were there. Maybe that's all they had to say. Some things just are there. They flare up, complex, perplexing, evading even scrutiny, let alone explanation. Then they go away, or you do, same thing. That is not something nature teaches, but it does tell us over and over again that we need to learn it. When I got home, I looked at the Wordsworth poem again. I saw a line this time, felt a line this time, lived a line this time that I never had before, the one where William says, right before he answers Matthew's critique, when life was sweet, I knew not why. Life, I thought, is never sweeter than when we don't know why. All of the sweetness in my life, with my wife, my kids, playing outside when I was a kid, writing and reciting to myself all of my poems, Walking in these woods on a day like this when all I can think about is how much my head hurts. Well, I have no idea why I have gotten to do any of it. So lucky, I know now, only because almost all of those things, except my headaches, are now gone. I miss them, yes, sometimes terribly, but that's not even the point. The best of my life just was, like the birds today, there, so sweet. No idea why. For whatever reason, once I crossed the road, I started thinking again, the cataract of my migraine clearing a bit, thinking specifically about my course, our next class, when we'd be discussing the essays that come due that day. The last time that happened, I used the moment to invite everyone to think reflexively about the nature and purpose of our course, which is proffered as the core graduate course in composition studies, open to those both in the field and not. I do this work through what I call thought experiments, like the one I described earlier for reading Emily Dickinson. This one was simple. Every week, pick one of the texts we are reading and ask yourself sequentially these questions. Number one, is this a text I would teach in a composition course? If so, how? If not, why? Number two, is this a text I would teach in a literature course? If so, how? If not, why? Number three, is this a text I would teach in a creative writing course? If so, how? If not, why? There's probably not one text we have read all term that belongs solely to any one of those three distinct areas of English studies. Plato, Aristotle, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, Wollstonecraft, Whitman, Dickinson, etc., into and then up through the 20th century. You get the picture. Any part of English studies could use any one of them in a myriad of ways. I had just for some reason done that little experiment for myself a few days before the class, for all of that week's assigned texts, and was surprised how I answered those questions. It led me to think how we decide, individually and collectively, consciously and unconsciously, who and what is going to matter to us in our field and for how long. I ended up that day kind of spontaneously recounting a story about how one of the college composition and communication conventions I went to back in the 1980s foregrounded this process very dramatically, for me at least. Anyone who attends those big annual conventions knows they have a pre-assigned theme that no one really pays attention to, except maybe to throw a few words gesturing toward it in your proposal to increase your odds of being selected. But they do very often develop a strong extemporaneous identity, one that just emerges or explodes once everyone gets in the restaurants and halls talking. The one that took over this one was, what is our canon in composition, which quickly morphed into, who are our stars? With a pronounced focus on the present, the luminaries who are actually there. It was quite interesting to observe, especially to see who would be talking him or herself up in public or in private, and who would be trying to keep an arm's length from the nomination process. It had the feel of one of those big deadlock political conventions from the 50s and 60s. Lots of goofy hoopla. Just by coincidence, I had been assigned ahead of time to a little panel that, because of this issue, became a bigger deal. I can't remember exactly why. But we were moved from a small classroom-sized space to a ballroom, each of us trotting out on stage in sequence like, here's Johnny, to deliver our 3-minute blast on the topic du jour. I was miffed to start with by the whole conversation, so I got more and more agitated as I talked, unscriptedly, blah, blah, blah. I realized I had to stop and had no conclusion, so I ended up with a call to just blow the whole thing up. I got a lot of applause. At least that's how I prefer to remember it in the utopia of my greatest hits. A blast, literally. And I had a blast setting it off. This, I said, is quite often how disciplines create and establish their identities, their canon, like a bevy of old pals marching around the ballroom with signs until enough of them vote for a candidate to put forth. You can't just ignore it or escape from it. But it's a good idea to do at least a little bit of thinking yourself. Then you won't be stuck just genuflecting to a big woods full of bronze figures or obsessing about a lot of noisy birds up on a hill on their way to or from nowhere you can figure out.